This is the Michael Lerner Conference with Common Will for February 28, 2006, beginning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time.
J. Peterson Myers, or Pete Myers as he's better known, Theo Colborne, and Diane Dumanowski will be our featured presenters on this call. It's scheduled for March 22nd at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. More information on this call will be disseminated over the coming weeks. I'd now like to turn the call over to Susan. Susan?
Thank you, Eleni. Good morning, everyone. As Eleni said, I'm Susan Marmagus, and I'm with the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. And it's really my pleasure today to moderate this call on nanotechnology. We know that the issue of nanotechnology is emerging and is of concern to many, while at the same time there are benefits from nanotechnology. We want to understand and ensure that we are addressing the risks that may be posed from nanotechnology. These risks could be to workers, consumers, the public, and the environment. So today's call is really going to look at this question of how do we get ahead of this emerging technology to protect public health and learn from the lessons in the toxics field. It's an important question, I think, ongoing, and it's one that we often talk about within the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Today's call we've organized to cover a number of issues around nanotechnology, background on nanotech, what is it, setting a frame, health implications of nanotechnology, policy efforts, both voluntary, regulatory, and legislatively, and also looking ahead into the future to look at issues both in the short term and in the longer term. What are the implications of nanotechnology down the road? So we have put a call together today with four speakers trying to cover the breadth of this issue, and we really look forward to the discussion that will follow the presentation because there are additional people on this call with expertise in this area, and we look forward to a lively discussion. The four speakers are going to set the context and talk about what nanotechnology is. They're going to cover the health effects science. They're going to talk about policy and regulatory issues with regards to nanotechnology. And they're also going to talk about the public perceptions of nanotech from some recent work that's been done at the Woodrow Wilson Center. As I mentioned, we're going to have plenty of time for discussion. We're going to keep the presentations brief so that we have time to really get into the Q&A. So with no further ado, I'd like to now turn. I'm going to introduce each speaker before that person speaks, and then we will open the Q&A after all the speakers have finished their presentations. The first speaker is Dr. Ken Geiser. Dr. Kenneth Geiser is professor of work environment and the co-director of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Dr. Geiser is one of the authors of the Massachusetts Toxic Reduce Reduction Act, and he served as the director of the Toxics Use Reduction Institute from its founding in 1990 until 2003. Dr. Geiser.
Thanks a lot, Susan. Yeah. So my task is to kind of talk about context, and I just jump right in by starting with the issue of scale. A nanometer is about a billionth of a meter in size. It's about the size of a DNA or the size of a few atoms put together. There's nothing particularly new here. Much of life's chemistry takes place at the nanoscale. Indeed, humans have evolved in an environment which is rich in nanoscale materials. Natural nanoscale particles are easily manufactured in combustion operations or grinding operations, and we've been making particles and pigments in carbon black for centuries. So what's new here? The newness comes from our very recent ability to manipulate substances at the molecular level. Only since the 1980s, when Harold Croteau and Richard Smalley first introduced the carbon 60 molecule, which they called the Buckminster fullerene because of its geodesic shape, and at the same time that we developed the atomic force microscope measure, have we been self-consciously manufacturing nanoscale particles with purposefully designed functionality. Indeed, the federal definition of nanotechnology has three parts. You still there? Are you there?
All parties are still online.
Okay. All right. Let me go on with the federal definition. The definition is materials or structures between 1 and 100 nanometers. Secondly, with novel or new properties. And third, that can be manufactured at the molecular scale. This is a big revolution. We are investing big in nanotechnology. Some 30 countries have nanotechnologies research programs, and the U.S. federal government is sinking over $1 billion per year into nanotechnology research and development. Now, nanotechnology suggests an active device. However, most research and most products on the market are simply passive materials that we should be calling engineered nanoparticles. This is where we are focused. These include one-dimensional nanoparticles used to make very thin films, two-dimensional nanotubes, which are tiny rolls of metallic particles, and three-dimensional spheres, which are often called quantum dots. These passive nanomaterials make up what would be called the first generation of nanotechnology. And this includes things like nanostructured metals, polymers, ceramics, composites, and catalysts. And this is what makes up most of the industry today. However, research is now entering the second generation, which is focused on active nanomaterials, such as sensors, monitors, amplifiers, switches, solar collectors, and targeted drugs. They all have a characteristic of being able to respond to changing conditions. There's projected a third generation, which will focus on systems of nanostructures making up very tiny devices and little machines, but this is yet a ways off. And there's talk of a fourth generation, the so-called molecular nanosystems, which people like Michael Creighton and Eric Drexler, who coined the term gray goo, worry about, because this is where devices become self-replicating. That's about what we know well. We know far less about a lot of important things. There's no national inventory of nanotechnology companies. About 18 months ago, there was an estimate that there's some 200 to 300 U.S. companies that are engaged in or preparing to engage in nanoscale production. There's no national list of nanoscale products. However, scores of manufacturing firms are touting products with nanoscale materials. They range from strengthening stabilizers and composites, used to detect radiation in sunscreens, used as brighteners in cosmetics, used in inks for computer printers, used as catalysts in reactions, and used as filters in water treatment. Now, in a couple of minutes, you're going to hear more about the risks of some of these. Let me just talk a moment about the potential benefits, because there is a talk about environmental benefits from these. The first has to do with waste remediation. There's work now that shows that increased reactivity, increased surface area allow nanoparticles to be used to react with contaminants in environments. For instance, zero valent iron has been used to inhibit chlorinated hydrocarbon movement in groundwaters, there's others that have been used to contain polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Second, there are sensors. The biological and defense fields are driving the development of sensors for detecting biological and chemical agents, and many of these could be used for sensing environmental contaminants at very low concentrations in real time and from remote locations. There's water treatment. Nanoscale filtration systems using zeolites could enable more water reuse, recycling, and desalinization, and currently there's significant research going on in this area. And there's industrial and farm production. Highly reactive nanofluids and designer selective catalysts can support green manufacturing by increasing energy and materials efficiency, minimizing solvent use, and reducing waste generation. The Department of Agriculture is currently funding research on precision-targeted nanoscale delivery systems for fertilizers and biocides that would reduce the use of nitrogen, phosphorus, and pesticides in agricultural production. And lastly, there's energy. Current research on high-strength, low-weight composites that reduce the weight of transportation vehicles, leading to substantial reductions in energy consumption. Carbon and metal nanowires that demonstrate high conductivity could significantly reduce the energy losses in electrical transmission. It's estimated that nanotechnology applications in generating lightweight vehicles, solid-state lighting, self-optimizing motors and smart roofs and high-conductance transmission lines could cut the nation's energy consumption by 15% per year. So that's sort of some of the really environmental benefits that are talked about and give a sort of a positive view on what nanotechnology could deliver. With that, I'm going to turn over to my colleagues to talk about some more sobering ideas. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Geiser. Our next speaker is Dr. Andrew Maynard, who is the Chief Science Advisor with the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Dr. Maynard is a physicist by training, formerly worked at the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, where he worked on nanoparticle exposure in the workplace. He's going to speak today about health effects science and the risks of nanotechnology. Dr. Maynard.
Thank you very much, Susan. Well, I had the gargantuan task of talking about nanotechnology and health risk in 5 to 7 minutes. So all I'm going to be able to do is really touch the surface of this subject and give you really an overview and perhaps some talking points for the discussion later on. But let's start from the beginning and try and put some context on this. And I think to do this, it's useful to go back to the fundamentals of what nanotechnology is. And Ken gave a very nice overview of nanotechnology. One of the ways of looking at it is that by manipulating matter at a very, very small scale, controlling it at a very small scale, it enables us to do new things, either produce materials with new properties or being able to put together structural functions of atoms to be able to do new things, new and innovative things. And so as soon as you have that context, there's a fairly obvious question that flows on from there, and that is, if we have materials and products that do new things, are there new risks associated with those materials and products? And this is really the central question that's been driving a lot of the discussion around nanotechnology and health risk, or nanotechnology and environmental risk. Well, it's okay to ask that question, but then in order to flesh it out, we really need to go back to the science and ask, is there any scientific basis for really exploring this question in any more depth? And that's really what I want to get into. And I want to start from a historical perspective, and Ken has already noted that there's nothing new about nanometer scale or nanometer size particles and materials. And I think this is a very important point to make. Ever since there's been fire around, we've been exposed to nanometer sized particles in the air. Even as we're sitting here at the moment listening to me speak, unless you're sitting in a clean room, you're going to be breathing in a lot of nanometer sized particles with each breath. Your skin is going to be exposed to nanometer sized particles. And so it's important to ask the question, what is different about some of these engineered nanomaterials which may lead to them presenting a greater risk than the materials we're exposed to every day? But there's also a flip side to the historical perspective, and that is, though we're exposed to very small particles on a daily basis, we also know that being exposed to the wrong sort of particles can make people pretty sick and even lead to death. It's been the history of occupational hygiene for the last 100 years or so, understanding precisely what it is about inhalation exposure, for instance, to airborne particles, which can really cause quite severe illnesses. So we do know that we need to be cautious when people are exposed to certainly small particles and small structured particles. Okay, going on to engineered nanomaterials. Let's get into the science and ask the question, first of all, is there anything unique about these which really makes us sit up and think? And the first thing we need to look at here is the importance of structure within these materials. We know that with most conventional materials, we can understand their potential health impact by looking at the chemistry of the material. But what is unusual about nanostructure materials is that their properties depend on the structure, how the atoms are actually physically arranged within these materials. And that means we need to change our paradigms for understanding potential health impact. We need to move away from that chemistry and mass-based paradigm and start asking the question, how does the structure of these materials potentially affect their behavior in the body? Now, when you marry that with research that's been done over the last 10 or 15 years, a number of things begin to become apparent. And just looking at three of those aspects. The first is looking at the size of particles, specifically looking at nanometer diameter particles. And we now know that size is very important in determining how particles behave in the body and where they actually end up in the body. So, for instance, if you look at nanometer-sized particles in the lungs, they don't appear to be cleared in the way that large particles are cleared, but they actually have an ability to pass out of the lungs into the bloodstream and hit other organs within the body and even enter cells within the body, something which large particles can't do. And there is some evidence, only in rodents at the moment, that these very, very small particles, if they deposit in the nasal region, can actually travel up the olfactory nerves into the brain, again, something that large particles can't do. The second aspect here, looking at structure, is the shape of particles. And we know historically that with materials such as asbestos, shape is very important in determining their biological response to them once they're in the body. And it seems now that if you take some fairly esoteric engineered nanomaterials, such as, for instance, carbon nanotubes, shape also plays an important role in how the body responds to those particles. And the third aspect here, which is a subdivision of shape, is looking at the importance of the surface of these particles. And you imagine here you have these engineered nanostructured materials, which are generally insoluble. So if they get into the body, they will retain their physical structure. That means that most of what happens in the body happens at the surface of those particles. And there is clear evidence now that certainly if you're looking at nanostructured materials in the lungs, it's the surface area and the surface chemistry of these particles which determines what happens, not the mass of the particles. And just to underline how important that might be, imagine you take a 5-micron-sized particle and push it into the lungs. You get a certain response. Now, if that response is associated with the surface of the particle, if you take that 5-micron particle and split it down into 5-nanometer diameter particles, so you have the same mass of material, the surface area goes up by a factor of 1,000. And so if you have a surface area-mediated response, you would expect that response to increase possibly by a factor of 1,000. This is why it's important when you're looking at a structural basis for activity to understand the structural nature of the materials that we're dealing with. Well, those three aspects have really just looked at one area of the risk equation, looking at the potential for hazard. There is also, obviously, another side of this. We need to understand something about exposure. And clearly, if you're looking at risk, exposure is critical to understanding the magnitude of risk. This is an area where we have very, very little information with engineered nanomaterials at the moment. What we do know, two things that we do know, is first that engineered nanomaterials are really quite precious still. People are making them intentionally, and they really don't want to lose them, which means that they don't want exposure to occur. The second thing we know is that many of these materials love to stick together. You look at experimental results from carbon nanotubes, for instance, and it's very, very hard to release them in a form that people are going to be exposed to them in. However, you need to counterbalance those two perspectives with two other perspectives. One is that although conventionally exposures may occur at very low mass concentrations, because of this structural dependency on properties, it may be that we can have fairly significant health dangers at low mass concentrations, but maybe high number concentrations or high surface area concentrations. The other aspect here is that we've got to be aware of unintentional releases and their impact on human health. It may be that in the perfect system, people aren't exposed to these materials, but somewhere at some point, someone is going to be exposed. So summarizing all that down, looking at the state of knowledge we have at the moment, I would say we have what I would call a number of red flags. We have enough evidence there to say we need to sit up and be a little bit careful, a little bit cautious about what the impact of some of these engineered nanomaterials is on human health, but we don't have enough information to carry out a quantitative risk assessment. In effect, we're in a point of uncertainty at the moment. We know there are important questions there that need answers, but we don't know what the answers are. And clearly, what we've got to be able to do, if this technology is going to succeed and we're going to have safe nanotechnologies, is move from that area of uncertainty to an area of certainty when it comes to risk. And the way we're going to have to do that is by carrying out an awful lot more research to fill some of these critical questions concerning how these materials may potentially impact on health. And I'm going to wrap up there, but I would just say one final thing. And Ken opened this up very nicely by pointing out that there are various generations of nanotechnology and engineered nanomaterials. Virtually all the information, scientific information we have on risk at the moment is based on that first generation of engineered nanomaterials, the very simple materials. One of the big challenges here is trying to understand the potential impact of the second, third, fourth generation of materials. And this is where we move out of an area where advances are evolutionary in terms of our understanding to areas where really we have to make fundamental leaps in our understanding of the interaction between some of these materials and devices and the body. Well, I'm going to wrap it up there. Hopefully I've said enough to spark off one or two interesting questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Maynard. We're going to move on to our next speaker. Karen Florini is the Senior Attorney at Environmental Defense. She is going to speak about federal and legislative and regulatory matters. Her area of expertise is in nanotechnology, toxic chemicals, antibiotic resistance, and she's going to cover the regulatory and policy issues related to nanotechnology. Karen.
Thank you, Susan. I want to start by mentioning that what I'm going to be talking about primarily is the regulatory arena for existing and relatively near-term engineered nanomaterials, not some of the multi-generation out ones, multi-generation in technological rather than human terms. I don't at all mean to imply that those things are not of significance, but they are still the realm of a lot of speculation. There's nothing that's on the market yet or coming onto the market along those lines, and so our focus is more on the stuff that is on or about to come on the market. I also want to start by just mentioning briefly, we think it's in everyone's interest not to be repeating the mistakes of the past with asbestos and DDT and Superfund and genetically modified organisms. That applies not only to consumers, but also to industry and government. We've got to be proactive and think about the full life cycle of risks as we examine potential concerns about nano. So what is the regulatory infrastructure as it now exists? Well, there's, as they once said about Oakland, there's not much there. There are some that may apply in theory, but almost none that currently apply in practice. Very, very few existing regulations appear applicable. There may be some statutory authorities that could be applied, but to do so would require full-blown rulemaking procedures, which would take quite a lot of time. Very few, if any, are actually under development at this point. In fact, I am not aware of any nano-specific regulations that are now being actively developed. There are, however, some provisions of OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act, where existing regulations and programs may apply now, and that's what I'm going to mostly be speaking about. OSHA's General Duty Clause, its Nuisance Dust Standard, and its Respiratory Protection Standard all in theory apply now, but all of them have serious limits, which we can get into in questions and answers if people would like some more specifics on that. In addition, I want to mention that CDC, NIOSH, has put out a sort of like a guidance document, but not quite. It's a safe approaches to, or approaches to safe nanotechnology and information exchange with NIOSH is what the name of the document is. It is open for public comment. It actually has some reasonably intelligent observations, although, as I mentioned, the exact status of this thing is unusual, to say the least. And, of course, whatever's in there is clearly not binding on anybody. The second statute to briefly mention, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, does require FDA to do pre-manufacturing review of drugs and medical devices, and that applies to nano substances as much to any other kind of substance. However, FDA has noted that it only regulates, quote, the claims, unquote, made by a product sponsor. So if the manufacturer is making no nanotechnology claims regarding a manufacturing operation or the performance of the product, then FDA may not even know that the product is a nanotech product or that it contains nanomaterials. The other thing that's very important to mention is that there is no pre-manufacture review of cosmetics. That is of concern because there are at least some current applications that contain nanomaterials in cosmetics and sunscreens. While FDA was asked to and did do at least a preliminary sort of evaluation of nano titanium dioxide use in sunscreens, that was sort of because people specifically came in and requested that. That's certainly not anything that's universal or mandatory. FDA itself notes, quote, FDA has only limited authority over some potentially high-risk products, e.g. cosmetics. The other thing that's important to keep in mind is that there is no life cycle review with respect to cosmetics. The agency would be looking at the direct health implications to the user, not in terms of impacts on at the production stage or after cosmetics are washed down the drain. I also want to talk briefly about the Toxic Substances Control Act. TSCA nominally regulates essentially all chemicals other than pesticides and other than ones regulated by the FDA under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. For chemicals that are deemed new chemicals, there is a requirement to submit what's called a pre-manufacturer notification. There are two issues of concern with respect to this. One is that it's not entirely clear which nanomaterials are new. Many of the nanomaterials that are now on or approaching the market are crystals of things that are basically much smaller crystals or much smaller particles than other materials that have been around for a while. For example, I just mentioned nanotitanium dioxide. That's an FDA application, but if there were non-sunscreen uses of it, it would nominally fall under TSCA. EPA has not yet issued guidance as to whether nano-sized crystals of things that are already on the market qualify as new. In addition, and somewhat more troublingly, some folks are arguing that things that have the same chemical formula are new anyway. I personally think that is a preposterous argument because under it, you'd say that diamonds and graphite are the same thing, and clearly that's not the case. The other limitation of PMNs, pre-manufacturer notifications, is that there is no requirement that they actually contain any toxicity data. If there are toxicity data that the manufacturer is aware of, they must be disclosed, but that's a far cry from actually saying go out and find out anything about the toxicity of the substance. In addition, under the Toxic Substances Control Act, EPA has the authority to issue regulations requiring disclosure of certain kinds of information relating to use and exposure and disclosure of existing toxicity studies. However, again, these are for products that are already on the market or for new ones. However, the agency has not issued any such regulations at this time. An EPA advisory committee did recommend that EPA initiate both a voluntary program and a companion regulatory one that would bring forward that kind of information, but no such program has yet been launched, and it's not quite clear what's going on with it. The last thing I'll mention about TSCA is that in terms of actually dealing with risks, it's a very weak read. There's a limited ability to do anything much, as indicated by the fact that only about a half dozen regulations have ever actually been issued to control risks under TSCA in terms of chemicals once they're on the market. There have been more extensive use made of some of the other provisions, but the sort of the key provisions on addressing risks to substances after they're already on the market, it's a pretty weak provision. The bottom line, then, is sort of don't hold your breath for regulatory safeguards, especially in the near term. There is some activity that is going on in terms of voluntary approaches. As I mentioned, the EPA potential initiative on reporting that was recommended by the advisory committee. There are also international standard-setting organizations such as ASTM that have nanotech committees that are looking at creating voluntary sort of standards of care and standards of practice. Those proceedings are very much at an early stage, and it doesn't look like anything's going to be coming out imminently, and it's also very unclear what they will contain when they do come out. Environmental Defense is working with DuPont, a major chemical producer, to see whether there is possible for us and them to develop jointly a framework that would provide for safe management of nanotechnology. But again, that is still very much in the initial phases, and when and if and what it will say remains to be seen. I want to close by mentioning that, as Andrew indicated...
This is Susan. If you can just wrap up,
yep,
that would be great.
That Andrew has said that one of the things that's clearly needed is a lot more federal funding, a lot more research on what the health and safety and environmental implications of nanotechnology are. Only 4% of the National Nanotechnology Initiative's billion-dollar annual budget currently goes for environmental health and safety implications. 14 organizations recently sent a letter to appropriations committees urging a substantial increase in that. That letter is still open for additional signatures, and a copy of it is on the CHE resources page for today's call, and anyone who would like to be added to that, please contact me, and I'm happy to add you to the list of signatories.
Great. Thank you, Karen. Our final presenter today is Dave Rajewski. David Rajewski is the director of the Project on Emerging Technologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center, formerly an EPA representative to the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and formerly with the White House Office of Science and Technology. Dave Rajewski holds graduate degrees in both public administration and environmental design, and he's going to talk about public perceptions regarding nanotechnology. David.
All right, thank you. It's interesting that we always talk about the public last, but I would maintain that this is probably one of the really large wild cards on the future for nanotech. I'm going to just quickly go through and summarize some research that we did in June. It took place in 12 groups across the country. These were what were known as experiential issue groups, and we sampled about 180 people. The people in these groups were almost an exact reflection of the 2000 census in terms of demographics. Unlike focus groups, these groups were actually given information about nanotech. They were told what it is, what the applications might be in right now and in the future, and we also gave them a lot of background material on government, various agencies, what their responsibilities were in terms of regulation and oversight. So let me just give you some of the kind of overarching findings. The first thing you can assume is probably 80 to 90% of the people that you'll run into have never heard of nanotechnology. So how they learn, from whom, and with what message is probably going to be very, very critical to long-term public acceptance. Once we educated these people to a certain degree, this is kind of what they told us in the groups. A lot of them anticipate major benefits. A majority of the people believed over the long term that the benefits would either exceed or equal the risks of nanotechnology. The areas that interested them the most were medical applications, followed by consumer applications, and then applications in the area of energy production, environmental protection, food and nutrition. Overwhelmingly, all of these people and a lot of people that have been subsequently studied in the UK and also in Europe were concerned about the existence of products in the marketplace and also the expenditure of billions of dollars in essentially taxpayer money with virtually little or no public involvement. So the public really, these people that we sampled, wanted to be included in some of the decision-making processes. We talked to them specifically about what they were concerned with in terms of nanotechnology, and a number of things rose to the top. One, they were concerned that there actually were some big unknowns out there. These were effects that could not be predicted by anybody, including the nanoscientists and the toxicologists. They were concerned about the efficacy of the regulatory system in terms of dealing with nanotechnology, and they were concerned about human health risks, both short-term, and they also had a significant amount of concern about long-term effects. Lower level concerns, but they were interesting. Like biotech, they were worried about, are we playing God here in terms of our ability to actually manipulate matter at this scale. They were concerned about potentially military uses and abuses, and there's also concern about what happens when this gets into the food chain. A lot of their perceptions are driven by their experiences with previous technologies. So there were essentially a lot of analogies that were made to past technologies, ranging from nuclear power to ag biotech applications. The interesting thing we found out is, despite the concerns, there was virtually no support for a ban on nanotechnology research or products. About three-quarters of them believe that a ban would be overacting or overreacting. There was, however, a very, very high demand for effective regulation. We actually tested the idea, Karen mentioned this, about how people felt about voluntary agreements. about 55% really believe that government control beyond voluntary standards is necessary. About a third are unsure, and only about 10% actually supported the idea of voluntary standards and believe those would be adequate. Attached to that is a general low public trust in government. Both this study we did and one that was done about a year before found that 90 to 95% of the people in the study had low or virtually no trust in government in terms of managing any of the risks associated with nanotechnology. That was only succeeded by their suspicions of industry. A lot of them had a widespread perception that industry pushes these products to market without adequate safety testing. They were going to make too many errors affecting people's health, and generally put their own motives ahead of consumer safety concerns. When we asked them to sort of tell us how to improve the trust levels, the one I think this is probably one of the most interesting findings, is there was an enormous convergence around two things that they wanted. This accounted for about 75% of the variance. The first one was they wanted more testing before the products were introduced into the marketplace, and they were hungry for information. In the U.S., that was just general information. Tell us what you're doing, industry and government, with nanotech. There's been some similar studies in the U.K. where a lot of that leads to concerns about labeling. I think the other interesting thing was we asked them specifically where they were finding out about nanotechnology. About 20-25% said it was from public television or radio. Another 20% indicated it was actually from other people. It was word of mouth. We've also done some subsequent work looking at what how nanotech is represented in the media. I'll just spend a minute or so on that. Basically, the big news there is it's not in the media. There's actually been very little media coverage. We looked at studies between the U.S. and the U.K. and the U.S. and Canada, and what you find is there actually is not much coverage in terms of how the news is framed. Certainly in Canada and the U.S., there tends to be a lot of framing around profiling of what the technology is, and it's a business and sort of market news story. Probably 20 to 30% of the stories that come out actually include some sort of risk-benefit discussion. There's studies at Lehigh that indicate that generally when EH&S issues are covered around nanotech, that the coverage has been relatively even-handed in the press, at least once you get below the headlines. Quite often the headlines get sensationalized, but the body of the text covers a fairly balanced view of what we know and what we don't know and what the risks and benefits might be. So I'm going to stop there. I think there's obviously an enormous opportunity and probably a huge challenge here when it comes to public engagement, and the government and industry has not even begun that engagement process.
Great. Thank you very much, David. And now I'd like to turn it back over to Eleni Sotos, who's going to open us up for our question and answer discussion period. Eleni.
Thank you, Susan. Adam, our operator, if you could please put all the participants in talk listen mode and let me know when that's done, I'd appreciate it.
We will do that now. Everyone, please be aware of your background noise. It will take just a moment. All parties should be free to speak.
Great. Thank you, Adam. Now, in order to keep the ambient noise down, I'm going to ask everyone on the line, before you do it, listen to what I have to say first. If you want to self-mute, we're asking everyone to dial *6 and to put yourself on mute, also to take yourself off of mute if you would like to ask a question. So, please. Wonderful. Okay, Susan?
Great. Thank you, Eleni. We have two people lined up to ask the first two questions or make a comment, and I'd like to turn to those two people now. Our first comment and question will come from Aditi Wasia, who's with the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. Aditi.
Thanks, Susan. I first wanted just to thank all of the speakers. I think it was great to get an overview of the different aspects of the potential implications of nanomaterials. The comment I want to make is that here at SBTC, we've been looking at nanotechnology in a variety of ways. But first, we kind of are thinking of nanotech as it's not a single-scale technology, that it's really a platform. And similar to the Industrial Revolution, we can think of this as nanotech as a new Industrial Revolution because it has the impacts are on a variety of industries and different sectors within markets. In terms of community impact, two quick examples that I'd love people's comments on. One is the implication on farmers of the use of nanomaterials in agribusiness. And we haven't actually started to work with farmers on this, and I'm wondering if anybody has started to talk to agricultural workers or farmers on kind of the known implications or the perspective implications of this. And the second really is that the Department of Defense, as one of the largest funders of nano research, is really promoting, one of the things that they're promoting by the use of nanotechnology is education. So one thing that we have started to do is talk to folks who are organizing around military toxic spaces, who have been trying to come up with alternative solutions to environmental remediation and know very little about nanotech. So what we're trying to do is educate them, but given the wide array of scientific information, we want to be able to keep them in the loop of what the up-and-coming science is. So given that there's such kind of little definitive science, my question is to the panelists, how would you think about outreach and education members?
Can you repeat that again, please?
Sure. So given the little known kind of definitive science, I'm wondering how folks would start to outreach and educate the most impacted communities and workers.
Thank you.
Who would like to take that question? Dr. Maynard?
I can say just a little bit about outreach and education very briefly. I think this is one of the big challenges we face at the moment, just getting people asking the right questions in different communities. And I think we can make an awful lot of progress if the right people were aware of the questions to ask. And by that, I mean you look at, say, the occupational hygiene community. At the moment, there are relatively few people out there that even know they need to ask specific questions about engineered nanomaterials. And at least if they started asking the question, if we have an engineered nanomaterial here, what is different about it which may change the risk it presents, I think we would make an awful lot of progress in protecting people's health. So in that respect, I think there's a huge need for very, very basic outreach and education with the people that are actually dealing with these issues on a day-by-day basis.
Other panelists want to respond to that question?
Yes, Dave Rajewski. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The first question about, or the first point about farm workers, I think was an interesting one. I think it raises the broader issues, is trying to get some sense of when particular communities of interest will be impacted and how. In the case of the food and agricultural applications, I think those are going to be quite varied. They're coming down the pike. We're releasing at the end of March an inventory of a lot of the nanotech-based research in agriculture and food. And one of the things that I think people will be able to see is what those products might look like in a year to 5 years out. And that also gives you some sense of who might be impacted. So we've done an analysis looking specifically at what areas might be manifested in particular areas, ranging from food packaging to pesticide delivery. And you can also get a sense of what the impacted communities might be, whether it's post-harvest. So food packers might be impacted pre-harvest, that sort of thing. So I think one of the ways you get a handle on that is actually going upstream a little bit and taking a look at what the research is and systematically analyzing that. But in the case of certainly the ag sector and the food processing sector, I think this database will give people some sense of who might be affected in the time frameworks.
Wonderful. We're going to move on to our next question, and that comes from Dr. Jennifer Stenberg.
Thanks very much to the speakers. It was an excellent presentation. I have one question. Who do you think is best set up to do the kind of testing that needs to get done? And I guess part of that is, where do you think the funding should come from? Should it come from all government or partial government and part industry? Do you think that government is best set up to do the testing? If you do, is it NIOSH? Is it National Toxicology Program? Should it be some independent? So how do you envision this testing getting done?
Can I make a first stab at that?
Sure. Yeah.
I think there are multiple levels here that you've got to look at. You've got to look at both short-term needs as well as long-term needs. You've also got to look at the need to develop a general level of understanding as well as understanding on specific products. And I think there are going to be both different groups and different funding mechanisms for addressing each of those. If you look at some of the more immediate information needs, for instance, looking at what is the risk associated with materials that are being developed now, products that are on the market now, I think there are some very, very specific questions that have got to be answered about the toxicity of specific materials, exposure to specific materials, and monitoring and controlling those exposures. Because those are such specific questions, I think you've got to go to, first of all, government research agencies that are used to dealing with answering very, very specific research questions like that. And that immediately brings you down to research agencies such as NIOSH and EPA, where they not only do they have a multidisciplinary environment, they're used to having people from different disciplines working together to look at applied research, but they're also used to dealing with industry as well and working within a broader context. Now, I would also say that the government is in a very good position for providing a general level of information which people can take and use to ensure that these materials and products are safe. There is also clearly a responsibility here within industry to develop very, very specific information. And one of the divisions of labor that I has been discussed, which I think is a useful starting point, is looking at the government developing very broad-based information which can be used, but then industry developing product-specific information which will ensure that those products and materials remain safe.
Great. Ken or Karen, do you have a comment on that?
Mine would be very similar to Andrew's. It's just a matter of getting some general information out. We need information right now, and government agencies should be funded for that, and then looking to industry for product-specific stuff. I think Andrew said it very well.
Great. We'd now like to ask for our next question.
I have one. My name is Andy Edgar. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I work at Clean Water Action. And I was wondering if there's any research or a connection with how much water is used to create things like nanotechnology, or if there's any sense of pollution in the creation of nanotechnology.
Andrew, this is Karen Florini at Environmental Defense. I think it's really important. I mean, we probably ought to be using the word nanotechnologies, plural, because there's really a very major range, the way you make different kinds of nano stuff. And I think for that reason, it's probably hard to give a cross-cutting answer to the question that you raise. There was an interesting session on greening of nanotechnology that the Wilson Center did. Was that just last week, Dave?
A couple weeks.
And to me, one of the strongest messages from that was how varied things are and how much it kind of depends on the particular product. It's not like, in other words, it's not like semiconductors, where which is really kind of one industry where it's pretty clear what specifically you're looking at. It's kind of all over the map and potentially even more so going forward. There are some kinds of nano productions that give me some cause for concern. The way they make nanotubes nowadays, it's a pretty high energy process and not a particularly clean one, for example. But as I say, there's a lot of variation in what we mean when we say nanotechnology.
I think one thing that's interesting is that one of the dreams of nanotechnology is being able to build things up atom by atom. So in principle, you don't have any redundancy there of material. You don't have any waste. Now, if that dream could be realized, I think we could end up with processes which really reduce either the amount of energy that's used or the amount of pollution that's produced. However, I think we've got to be careful that a lot of these industries, we're dealing with very complex issues, and it's very easy to take a simplistic view that says nanotechnology is going to lead to less pollution, less waste, whereas in reality we may find that that is not the case in some instances.
Great, thank you. Next question, please.
So yes, this is Jack Leesom, an epidemiologist in North Carolina. I'd like to ask, what is involved in measuring of these materials, these particles in the environment, if you're trying to measure exposure or even in the body? Can they be measured, and what's involved in it?
Let me take that. The answer is yes, they can be measured to a certain extent. We have quite a number of technologies out there which can measure either very, very small quantities of material or measure very, very small particles. In air and water isn't too difficult. It gets a little bit more complex if, say, you're looking at materials in the soil. And so, for instance, give you a couple of examples. Electron microscopy and atomic force microscopy are both two very good ways in which you can measure very, very small particles. You've also got technologies out there which will measure structural components of materials such as the surface area. The big problem we have is that most of these techniques are limited to the laboratory. There are very, very few techniques out there which you can just buy off the shelf for very little money and go out and either monitor exposure or monitor releases. And so this is an area where certainly more research is needed to simplify the techniques and make them more applicable and more viable.
What about in the body?
Right. In the body, things get a little bit more complex. There are techniques there which can actually detect on a chemical basis very, very small quantities of material, obviously. But say you wanted to detect an individual nanoparticle or a cluster of nanoparticles in the nanoparticle state in a specific part of the body, that is a challenge which nobody has really solved yet.
Andrew, I thought they just did a study on... They managed to radio label some nanotubes and could do tracer studies.
They did, yes. That was with mice, and they were looking at excretion of the nanotubes. And again, yes, you can apply tracers to these materials, but applying tracers is really hard science, and there are only a few labs that are available to do that.
And there's also, as I understand it, some concern that when just by putting, since we're talking about stuff that is active sort of in such small scale, you may change the nature of what the thing is by putting a tracer on it?
Yes. There are ways in which we're pretty sure that the tracers can be benign if say, you just take one atom out and put a sort of radioactive atom in its place. But yes, there are other ways of adding tracers to the surface of particles where you may well change the properties of those particles. So it's still a very, very young area of science, and people are sort of learning from their mistakes at the moment.
That wouldn't help in a human population study.
Exactly, yes. And if you're looking at a broad population, especially in epidemiology, that have been exposed to a material, you can't easily use tracers like that. And there are no obvious solutions at the moment. One thing that people have talked about is trying to develop appropriate biomarkers, but really that's no more than speculation at the moment that something is available and can be used.
Great. We have time for one more question.
This is Terry Collins from Carnegie Mellon University. I think I'd like to ask, especially Andrew, but maybe the other panelists, what efforts are being made to keep toxic elements out of nanoparticles? I see a lot of literature out there on cadmium sulfide and lead, cadmium selenide and lead sulfide. And if you're going to be using these to make nanomaterials, especially for distributive technologies, it's hard to see how you could stay out of trouble.
It's a very interesting question, actually, and I think we're sometimes in danger of getting so caught up in the nanoparticle side of things that we forget about what we know about how dangerous some of these other materials are. I think to answer that, you've got to look at context. Clearly, there are going to be some applications where you can use materials such as cadmium, and you're not going to have any exposure either to people or the environment, and so you can have what I would call a relatively safe application. But then there are going to be other instances where it's not going to be appropriate to use materials like that. Now, I would also add to that, there has been quite a lot of focus about how you can make nanotechnologies which are somehow going to come into contact with people in the environment as benign as possible. And that either means using some of these more dangerous substances but somehow pacifying them, or passivating them, or finding substitutes for those substances which retain the functionality.
I could just add to that just briefly from lab stuff that's going on in universities I'm aware of, and that is there's almost no sensitivity to that. Only in the last 6 months have I seen much in the way of what you call green nanotechnology conversation. I think the Woodrow Wilson's done a piece, but about four other places have picked up this theme, and that leads over into kind of a green chemistry interaction with this subject, which could raise that kind of question. And I leave it at that. Terry would be an excellent person to engage that.
Great. Well, at this point, I would like to thank all four presenters for excellent presentations and great answers in the Q&A discussion. Thank you all so very much. This obviously is an area of extensive interest amongst the collaborative community. We are hoping that we will continue to have more nanotechnology and health implications. So thank you again to all of the presenters and everyone who joined us today. I'd like to now turn it back to Eleni Sotos, who is going to wrap up this call. Eleni.
Thanks, Susan. Again, thank you to all the speakers and comments and questions. Two quick things. I do want to mention that we are going to have an audio MP3 file and the transcripts of this call up on our website over the coming week or two. And also, our next partnership call is scheduled for March 22nd at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and we will be discussing endocrine disruptors, the current state, what we know, the impact on environmental health, and we're going to have the authors of the seminal book, Our Stolen Future, on as presenters. Thanks, everyone. We look forward to talking with you next month. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.